Blog Talk Radio.
Not yet.
You are listening to WithInsightsRadio.com on the Blog Talk Radio Network, your free online holistic publication resource radio for trusting your intuition, achieving self-discovery, and following your soul self.
Good evening. This is Chief Cloud Pilot, and I'm here with Chief Wellamuck, and it is Namenha Radio.
Good evening.
We want to again thank Blog Talk Radio with Insights on Blog Talk Radio. That's now with Insights is Ignacio Garcia, and we love him and really want to thank him for helping us put this together and do this every week. We're going to talk about some myths tonight, but first of all, we have had a question or two come on over the internet.
Yeah,
and I think it's a good idea, and let's just talk about that, because one of them is really, really a good one, and we get this in the clinic, in the healing center a lot, because it's a big deal. I mean, the gluten-free this and the gluten-free that's one of the biggest fads out there now, and it's really earning a lot of money for a lot of corporations right now.
Well, and the other question we received was about cleanses.
Right. So let's take
so
that.
Those two topics
those
alone,
two that,
we get asked that a lot here.
Oh, yeah. But let's do this gluten-free thing, because let's talk about that a little bit, because it is. It, on the one hand, is a very, very serious issue for people who have the problem of gluten intolerance. I mean, no denying it. It is a nightmare. Now, back in the old days, seems like you never heard of gluten intolerance 10 years ago. I mean, ever. Before that, we talked about things like celiac disease, and celiac disease is a disease. It is an absolute gluten intolerance.
Very specific.
Yeah, and you eat gluten, you have celiac disease, and you can just expect to have diabetes, the blowhole. I mean, and chronic and constant. I mean, that doesn't sound wonderful, but, you know, that is, you know,
PG-13.
Terrible. You know, we're not talking about irritable bowel here. Mm-hmm. Celiac disease is something that,
It is a categorically allergic reaction to a specific protein.
Right, the gluten. But recently, I mean, it seems like over the past two decades, gluten intolerance has become a pretty general thing. Just about everybody is to some degree gluten intolerant, and it's perplexing for natural healthcare practitioners, because some people really, really are gluten intolerant, mm-hmm. and they get very sick, and it causes a lot of inflammation, and other people don't seem to be all that bothered by it.
No.
They might eat something high in gluten and get some gas. The question is, how come? What is the big deal, you know, and how can we figure that out? Why do some people really have bad reactions to gluten and other people just don't? Well, it has to do with basically that we are none of us cookie cutter sufferers. We're not cookie cutter people. We're not going to be well in a cookie cutter way. There's no generalization when it comes to wellness, and so therefore it stands to reason that when it comes to illness, there's no generalization there either. But let's understand what's going on with gluten. Why is it such a problem? And that will segue into some of the other things I want to talk about tonight with you. Gluten was not a problem except for a very small percentage of people for a long, long time. And that it has developed into a problem because of manufacturing. So let's go back in time to when gluten and celiac disease was very rare. Let's say 70 years ago. Let's go back a little farther, because a change happened in agriculture that has brought on the gluten crisis. Little by little, until finally now we are to the point where so many people are gluten intolerant that it becomes of economic concern, and manufacturers are really cashing in on this economic concern. And that sounds terrible, but that's exactly what's happening. Companies are making millions and millions and millions of dollars because of the suffering of people. So let's go back. Let's go back in time to say, you know, four generations back, where wheat was grown across the Great Plains and in Russia and all over the place. and there were very few gluten intolerance. We actually called those celiac disease or disorder. Back in those days, wheat was grown to, well, wheat has always been grown to a certain point, mm-hmm. and that is, you know, to the point where we can do whatever it takes to get it milled. But back in the day, the wheat was actually grown to the soft cheese state, and then it was harvested. And you'd go out in the wheat field, and when it was coming to harvest season, you'd go out and you'd take some of the corns, and you'd pinch them with your fingernail to know, and the farmers would know exactly when you were at that soft milk or soft cheese state. If it's too early, then you're in the milk state, and a white fluid would come out of the wheat kernel.
Right.
If you squeeze it and pinch it with your fingernail and it's hard, then you're in the rock state. And in those, back in the day, that wheat was only suitable for animal feed. It was never used for human beings. Weird, huh?
So ironic.
Ironic, yeah. The wheat had to be harvested at the cheese, a soft cheese state where you could pinch it with your fingernail and it would dent and it would be soft, but no fluid, white fluid would come out. At that point, the gluten level in the grain is very, very low. There's very little gluten in that grain at that point. And then what they would do is that they would dry it in the shuck. And I know you're very young, so you've probably...
I know what a shuck is. I read.
Well, I've seen photographs. Not photographs, but I've seen illustrations. At Thanksgiving time, people make shucks for decorations, you know.
I'm pre-millennial. It means I know more about history than NSYNC or Backstreet Boys. Okay.
Okay. But the shuck is a product of harvesting the grain with a scythe. And so you would go out and you'd scythe and you'd gather the grain together in a shuck and you tie it with a bit of grass, mm-hmm. and you would actually stack the shucks up together, standing up, and then they would dry. But they're not connected to the roots anymore.
Right.
And so that grain would dry without developing more gluten. Because it has to be dry in order to be ground. Mm-hmm. And this worked with stone grinding. All the mills were stone grind. You take all your... And of course, you'd winnow that out and beat the grains and take the grains to the stone mill. And there were set up in neighborhoods, mm-hmm. not the regions where, and you take your grain to one mill. Everybody took their grain to the same mill.
Right.
And it would all be milled, and you would have flour that was high enough in gluten to make bread, but not so high in gluten that it irritated the gut or caused the problems we have now. But that was back when America was just barely making enough wheat for itself. You know, all the farmers were making enough wheat for themselves and a little bit to sell, and so America ate bread. Then a revolution happened in agriculture. An absolute revolution happened called the roller mill. And the roller mill is not the same as the stone mill. In the stone mill, you're actually grinding two big stones together, and you put wheat in between those two stones, and what came out was a fine flour. But it was still a pretty coarse flour and had to be sifted.
Yeah.
Everything. When you made anything with wheat flour or corn flour or any of the flours back in the day, you had to sift. When you go back into some of the old videos of Julia Child's The Art of French Cooking, uh-huh. you'll see that she's using this, especially with pastry, she takes wheat flour, and the first thing you do is you sift, and you sift the materials in with the wheat flour.
I remember when we were living with great-grandma Dilworth mm-hmm. in Idaho, mm-hmm. she had a stone grinder. Countertop stone grinder.
Right, she ground all her wheat.
She only ever ground her own wheat, and I remember one of the chores that we had while living there with her was to sift.
Sift the wheat to make the white flour.
And
yeah.
Man, was that a chore.
What a pain. Yeah, what a pain. But that was part of the preparation of food. The preparation of all food with flours required sifting. Mm-hmm. Well, today you read recipe books now, and you don't see the word sift because you're buying all-purpose flour. It's already done. Yeah. The reason you can do that is because of the roller mill. The roller mill are steel. And in the roller mill, they can reach speeds and temperatures and grinding capacity that far outreach the stone mill. But the wheat had to be grown to rock state. It didn't work in the soft cheese state. The roller mill,
it would bind up the roller mill.
Well, it bound it up. Yeah, it turned it. Yeah. You'd end up with cardboard, wheat cardboard,
which would just have to be reground once it was dried.
Yeah, and so what they did was they changed the way wheat was grown because they changed the way wheat was ground. And the key issue here is that so much more wheat could be ground at a time that the ability it created the ability of producing a surplus of wheat or corn or rye or barley or what have you. And so roller mill, beyond question, roller mill became the bomb. I mean, it was the big technological advancement that was going to feed the world, and literally the roller mill created the Green Revolution. And so suddenly, farmers had the ability to go out and overplant. Because now other engineers were coming up with machinery that could actually cut and harvest the wheat at the later stage, which it could not do at the earlier stage because it just bent it over.
Yep.
At the later stage, when everything is all grown out and all the water is out of the plant, you can just go on through and mow that down and with a swather, with a grain harvester, and take that hard grain, and you wouldn't lose half your crop with your equipment. So now we move into the technological age, technological agriculture, technoculture, technology far from answering the problems of, you know, the growing need for food actually did produce a lot more food.
Oh, yeah.
Now America and Russia become the breadbaskets of the Northern Hemisphere, and Argentina and places like South Africa became breadbaskets for the Southern Hemisphere. But the problem is, when you grow the grains out completely to the rock-hard state, you have a high degree of gluten. And nature has done this to prepare the seed to winter over. The seed has to have massive amounts of fuel to be able to winter, to stay alive all winter long, and still have that packet of fuel in the spring that allows it to germinate. Whereas if you try to plant a seed that you have harvested at the cheese state, they won't grow. That were dried in the shuck, they most of them will not germinate. So the farmers would grow some all the way out to plant next year or in the fall if they're doing winter wheat. But that wheat was never used for food. It was seed wheat, and it was high gluten, and it needed to be high gluten. Well, now, because of the roller mill and because of technology and because of industrial agriculture, that's all the wheat we have. So you can go down and you can buy whole wheat. You can get whole wheat, organic whole wheat, and it is still so high in gluten that you can't eat it. So many people are allergic to it who were never allergic to that sort of thing
pesticides,
before.
Pesticides, GMO, it makes no difference when it comes to gluten because of the way it's harvested and processed.
That's right. And there is one thing, however, the GMO, gluten, the manufacturers love gluten because it makes fluffiness.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's really, really good stuff. So there has been quite a bit of activity in actually producing grain with more gluten.
So first off, you have a grain that naturally has way more gluten.
Oh, sure.
After it, you know, as opposed to how it was grown before. And then you have some mild genetic modifications to
bump it up.
Double that.
Yeah, to double the gluten. So now we've got double the gluten, and we're using grain in a way that the human, you know, we grew up with grain.
Yeah.
We evolved with grain. Humans have been alongside grain since, you know, the first pot was made.
We found 5,500-year-old grain in ancient tombs in China.
Right, the pot. The first pots were made not to carry wine or water or soup or what have you.
It was grain.
It was grain. It was to store grain. And so as long as the potter, the first industry was pottery, and, well, right alongside, I don't know, weaving. I think it was probably pottery because you had to put up enough grain to have livestock.
Right.
So they weren't even making wool, you know, before they were making pots, and the first pots were made to store grain that had been dried in the shuck. Well, now we have the ability to store grains in huge, huge elevators and overproduce the grain because of the issue of gluten. And because of that, we have a whole population worldwide that, even though we evolved right alongside the grain, in great measure, civilization exists because of corn and wheat.
Mm-hmm.
But even though that is the case, we now can't eat it. We're getting more and more, you know, explosively allergic
to
grain or to a gluten. Intolerant is the word, gluten intolerance. But why then do some people explode and others not? You know, why does this cause so much inflammation in some people and in some people it just simply doesn't? It's just a stronger constitution and probably a great deal stronger internal gut flora. And that smacks at some of the other problems with processed food, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it isn't just a gluten problem. It is an overall digestive tract problem. So let's review some of the anatomy, physiology, especially down in the intestines. The small and large intestines are lined on the inside with a mucus layer, a layer of mucus, not just mucus membrane. I mean, we've got mucus membrane in our mouth and our noses and
eyelids. This is thick.
This is a mucus membrane that actually produces a gelatinous thick coating of mucus. And it's different than that which is in our noses, our mouths, our ears, and our eyes, and in other parts of the body.
Yeah, this layer is actually more like your culture auger that use in a laboratory.
In a laboratory, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think of it as this, and you midwives out there that might be listening, you kind of get this object here. Babies are often born with a thick coat of cheese all over them that the nurses then wipe off before giving baby to mom, right?
Yeah, usually.
I have seen this in my own children, and it's gooey and it's thick and it's literally like sort of a cottage cheese on there. And you look at it and I think this is the reason for so many generations men were not allowed to be around when the babies are born because, you know, cut and shoot a deer, but, you know, hold that and wash off the, well, let's just go on.
Or not.
Or not. That's very similar in makeup to what, well, not in composition, but it's kind of a similar idea. It is there to protect the baby while in the uterus. And what is it protecting the baby from? Well, the uterus, the waters of life are filled with life. The baby is actually developing in a soup that is just teeming with microbes. Some of them, most of them, are there to help digestion happen and the transfer of nutrients, but also, because it isn't just the placenta and the umbilical cord where nutrients are flowing. We know what the skin is all about now, so there's a lot of nutrient flow. But also, to make sure that the baby has the biome when they're born. But
as a programmed defense mechanism.
In the uterus,
the baby has no immune system. It's the mother's immune system. But most of the immune cells, only a select number of immune cells are allowed through the placenta into the baby.
Exactly.
So what you have is a highly, ordinarily infectious solution of goop around the baby and a natural defense mechanism and literally sliming the baby.
Yeah.
That's the dangerous organisms which are competing against all of the other pathogens that could harm that fetus. You have this slime that dangerous biota can't get into.
Right. It has to pass through. And what's interesting is that in that coating, there are actually virus that wipe out the bacteria that try to get through. Well, lining the inside of our intestines is kind of an analog. There is a mucus lining in there that needs to be of a certain consistency and a certain thickness in order to house the right number of what we call bacteriophages.
Mm-hmm.
Bacteriophages are virus. They're not humans. They're not human cells. They're not human DNA.
They're parasites.
They are parasites. The bacteriophages live in the mucosal lining, and they're absolutely not human. They are invading parasites that have learned and to live in the human body and form a symbiotic relationship. Now, here's the relationship. There are
Thanks
also,
a lot, Mom.
Yeah, it's Mom's fault. There are also a lot in the gut, a lot of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of this bacteria is what we call the friendly, and we rely on it to get some of our vitamins, for
yeah,
example.
Yeah, but they're only friendly so long as they're doing their jobs and not eating us instead of the food.
Exactly. Well, that's just the key. A lot of digestion that happens in the gut happens because there's bacteria there doing the digestion, mm-hmm. not us doing the digestion. The bacteria is breaking materials down even smaller than we can possibly so that it can pass into the bloodstream and there continue to be broken down and carried into the cells. We cannot, through any process of our digestive system, break most of the proteins down, for example, into sizes suitable to enter the capillaries. So bacteria is there, especially for the lignous material,
right.
Trans,
yeah.
the big protein
mm-hmm.
chains, heavy fats. They break and they mix and they break and they mix and they're there. But the thing is that the food that we eat that is heavy in fats or proteins, whether they be plant proteins, plant oils, or lignous material, that's not that much different than the actual epithelial tissue of our digestive systems.
Not a whole lot. Gluten in particular is a fairly stable, difficult to digest substance. So it requires a highly aggressive bacterial organism,
mm-hmm.
something with an advanced digestive function that produces high concentrations of specific enzymes to break gluten down into usable food matter.
Right. It's literally a fermentation
mm-hmm.
process. Well, there's not a lot different between that and those bacteria. There's not a lot of barrier between those bacteria that are so
mm.
aggressive in digestion and the actual wall of the intestine. And they like that kind of food. They're made for that kind of food.
Mm-hmm.
And so coating the inside of the intestines is this mucus layer. And when those bacteria get a marsh hair and start boring into that mucus layer to get at the proteins and the fats of the epithelial tissues instead of concentrating on what's coming down the pike.
Right.
The bacteriophage virus resident in that mucus, in that mucosal layer, attack the bacteria
mm-hmm.
and eat the bacteria. And guess what happens to the bacteria?
Ta-da!
It turns into broken protein chains, amino acids, and lipids that actually pass into capillaries.
Or get digested by other bacteria.
Or they get eaten
yeah.
as food by the other bacteria, but much of it actually passes into our bloodstream, and that is how we get a whole bunch of protein by the death of bacteria.
This constant microbiological chemical warfare
or
is responsible for digestion.
Yeah.
Our digestion.
Folks, you need to understand what's going on in the gut. It is a violent environment. And it must be a violent environment where life is being torn apart and recombined. It has to happen. And so here we have some interesting things happen. Number one, we're becoming so gluten intolerant because of so much gluten in the wheat. So we eat this stuff. It doesn't properly break down. The violent digestive processes can't take place in a timely manner. And so guess what happens? They go on in an untimely manner. And when you have fermentation that goes on too long in the gut, you have lots of release of methane and carbon dioxide. You have lots of production of inflammatory chemistry,
mm-hmm.
which now begins to irritate and strip like a window cleaner the mucosal lining of the gut.
Yeah, the impact of gluten in the intestines involves one of a couple of interactions normally. One is what's called a hygroscopic.
Right.
Hygroscopic reaction.
Hygroscopic.
Where irritation is detected, substances are not digesting properly, they're not fermenting properly, so the body will flush the intestines with water in order to wash it deeper into the bowel.
Right.
Where the further down you get, the more aggressive the organisms get.
Exactly. Get it down where those really bad guys are.
You know, and a lot of this accounts for the diarrhea associated with the consumption of gluten.
And the bloating and the gas and the pain.
Right.
That's right.
Then there's another factor, another reaction, that is the bacterial bloom as a result of gluten.
Precisely.
It's the nature of bacteria. There's so much of it in us. You feed one in particular more than the others.
Explosion.
It blows up and will compete with all the other organisms.
Well, it outcompetes. It does
it overcompetes.
Better. Yes. Yeah. It prevails.
It dominates.
It dominates. The others are the ones that don't compete.
Well, these are highly aggressive bacterial organisms.
Oh, sure.
And in high enough concentrations, they overpower the bacteriophage's abilities in the mucosal lining to break the bacteria down, to stop
right.
them.
That's
Once
right.
they get to epithelial tissue, that's much easier to digest than gluten.
Right, much. It chooses the body of the host over the gluten. And that's why many people just explode. They have inflammation, they have diarrhea, they have gas, they have fever. It's incredible. And the pain is very real. The pain is excruciating, very real. I mean, the old days, you got a little gas pain and you went on, changed your position and it went through. But no, not with this. Oh. Not with this. It does not change anything. So it's a very real thing. And the origin of it is how we decided to industrialize food.
Mm-hmm.
The end result, we don't know what the end run of this is going to be.
All we know is a couple of generations after the change, and the vast majority of Americans are gluten intolerant.
Yep, two, maybe three generations have passed now, and the vast majority of Americans are to some degree or another gluten intolerant and need to be taking a look at this. So what do we do? Is it actually the gluten that is the concern, or is there something that we are not paying attention to? And I'll tell you what, concurrent with the increase in gluten is the increase in food additives, which also disturb and destroy both the mucosal layer of that layer of mucus, but also the normal biome, the normal bacteria and virus and fungus that is in the bowel that does the job. And so, we're adding insult to injury by eating the rest of the garbage that we're eating. Now, I've got some examples here of food. I purposefully did not get an example of a gluten-free recipe. While we're talking, would you get on your phone and come up with ingredients of a gluten-free food? Because what I'm going to do here is I'm going to compare the ingredients of what I consider a very bad food with what, and these are processed foods, with what the whole world would consider a much better food. One's a health food and one is definitely not. So I'm going to read the ingredients from one of the country's favorite snack foods, quick foods. And this comes in a box, or a bag, I'm sorry. Comes in a bag, and of course we've spoken the rule about food. There are two rules.
A number of times today.
today to some actual sufferers.
You get some funny looks when we do it. Well,
there are two rules. One of them is quite simple, and the other one requires us to rub our last remaining two brain cells together, get some friction, and think about it. But the first one, most of us have at least two together, rubbed together, right? Two in the same place, and smack them together, we get an idea. The first one is very simple, though. The rule of thumb is Michael Pollack's rule of thumb, and that is eat real food. Real food, mostly plant, and not too much.
Yes.
Now, that's not that big of an issue. I mean, it's not a hard stringent rule. If you just pay attention to whether you are asking corporations to make your food or if you're making your food, you're going to be a whole lot closer to real food if you're making your own food. But
right.
if you're asking corporations for permission to eat and to live and to thrive, then in all likelihood, you're going to get what I'm going to read now. Now, this is quite a hold that thought.
Yeah.
This is quite a bad food. And let me see if you can guess what it might be. It begins with whole corn. Now, not whole grain corn, whole corn. We really don't know what that means. But it is Monsanto corn or Cargill or whatever they dole out. And, you know, this is not whole corn anymore. This is corn that will not grow if you plant it.
Right.
Not too long ago, a couple of years ago, there was a farmer who was growing corn down there by the Sac River. And the hailstorm came through and knocked down about half of the field, or about three-quarters of the field. So there was no point in harvesting the corn. So he called up all the Amish people that he knew and all the anarchists that he knew and all the Mennonites that he knew and all the little isolated communities that he knew. And they said, come on over and pick up this corn we were going to be harvesting this week. We can't harvest it. It's been knocked over. The harvester's not going to be able to get the cobs. So they came in the droves and they filled up their pickups, you know, pickup after pickup and truck after truck of this corn. And one of my neighbors thought, Rick, it's so funny. He just thought, I'm really curious about this corn because the ears are big and long. The ears must have been over a foot
uh-huh.
long. Lots of kernels on this corn. And he said, I just don't remember ever eating corn on the cob
that was
a foot and a half long. You know, that was as big around as my fist. And so he asked the farmer, what kind of corn is this? And he said, well, you don't want to eat this corn. It's not really for human consumption. It's okay for my neighbors, but they won't let us. They won't let us sell this kind of corn. Although it was corn for automobile paint, corn that was going to be made into paint.
Oh my goodness!
It was oil corn.
Yeah.
So he was letting the neighbors take it away, hoping that they were just going to feed it to their livestock and not eat it themselves, because it really was engineered not to be food for people.
Well, knowing our neighbors, they would have absolutely started cooking it up and eating it.
Well, you saw it at the farmer's market.
Yeah.
All over the place you had this corn at the farmer's market.
Oh.
People were buying like crazy. Whole corn. So when you read a label and you see the word whole corn and not whole grain corn, it might be a good indicator that this is not good corn, maybe.
It's at least not what it at first appears to be.
Yeah. We don't know what corn that is. It would stand to reason that you'd want to get with the manufacturer, call the manufacturer, and find out what corn was used this week. So the next ingredient is vegetable oil. Now, this can be corn oil, soybean oil, or sunflower oil, but it doesn't say which.
It could also be canola oil.
No, it's right here. It says corn oil, soybean oil, sunflower oil.
Those
in parentheses, that it has to be one
it
of those three.
Of those, yeah.
The manufacturer has no idea which in a given week. They don't know and they don't care. So, you know, if you're not eating soy or if you're allergic to sunflower, you can't eat this product, but you wouldn't even know because this is a bagged product. Now, the other rule of thumb, obviously, in food, if it's in a bag, bottle, box, or can, you're reading the label.
Right.
And you're understanding the label. So help me understand this label. The next ingredient is salt. And what I want you to do while I do this, well, let's just go on. The next one is cheddar cheese, which consists of milk, cheese, cultures, salt, and enzymes.
Right.
Okay.
Gotcha.
The next is maltodextrin. What is maltodextrin?
Oh, that's a sugar byproduct.
It's a starch.
It starts from malt, wheat, isn't it?
It's maltodextrin is actually usually made from corn.
Gotcha. Right. That's right. Yeah.
Malted corn. The next ingredient is wheat flour. Now, this is not whole wheat flour.
It's just wheat flour.
It's just wheat flour. So this is industry standard wheat flour. Then there's whey, and then there's monosodium glutamate.
Of course.
Buttermilk solids, partially hydrogenated soybean oil, corn oil, cottonseed oil. This is not and. So we have vegetable, we have corn oil, soybean oil, or safflower oil. And then a little further down, we have partially hydrogenated soybean oil, partially hydrogenated corn oil, and partially hydrogenated cottonseed oil. When you partially hydrogenate these oils, you make it standard, stable at room temperature, which means you could do a sculpture with it. You know, it stands up.
Also means it lasts a lot longer and is much, much, much cheaper.
It's much, much, much cheaper, and it is a long-chain hydrogenated molecule that the body cannot even consider oil. It looks at it as a polymer and treats it more as a hormone than an oil.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, here's some problems. You have all three of those. The next one is disodium phosphate. We talked about this a little earlier. In industry, what is disodium? In the industry you worked in, what did the boss man use disodium phosphate for?
Oh, he used it to clean the vessels after mixing photochemicals.
So he used it to clean the plastic and stainless steel
vessels.
Usually
stainless steel. Some of these chemicals bind to the metals and the plastics. So
right.
Really vigorously.
They chelate.
They're supposed to. They're supposed to bind inks and pigments to silver-plated paper
to metals
for developing pictures,
right?
Photo development. So this chemistry has to be stripped off without something that is going to, you know, burn the tank away,
right?
And that's why they use
the metal
disodium
right.
phosphate or trisodium phosphate, because it will remove the chemistry off the sides of the tank without corroding the metal.
So right in the middle of the recipe, you're telling me that there is a soap.
Correct.
There is soap in the middle of the recipe.
You gotta save the equipment, man.
Okay, now I'm gonna put a little star by that because I would like any of you who want to really understand what's going on in gluten intolerance to go to your sink and take a tablespoon and fill that tablespoon with dish soap and swallow it. This will not kill you. This will not kill you. But if you want to know what gluten intolerance feels like, you will now know.
Yep.
And isn't it interesting that there is detergent soap in the middle, hidden right in the middle of the ingredient list in this food that is very, very popular? Lactose.
Sugar.
Natural and artificial flavors.
Petroleum.
Dextrose.
Sugar.
Tomato powder. Spices. Lactic acid. Artificial color. Yellow 6, yellow 5, red 40.
Lactic acid. Oh, that just gives it a little bit of the tingle, the little bit of a sting on the product.
It probably has it. It's part of the chemical reaction
that
cooks it the way they want it. Citric acid. And go figure, sugar. And it has garlic again, red and green pepper, garlic powder, red and green pepper powder, sodium caseinate, disodium inosinate, soap, disodium guanylate, soap, non-fat milk solids, whey protein, isolate, and corn syrup solids. Now, listen, folks. When you're putting this, there's some gluten in here because there's some wheat flour.
Yeah.
But I'm here to tell you the gluten in that product is not the problem. You could make this without any gluten. You could take all the wheat out of this product and you will still have death in a bag. Taking the gluten out of this is a no-brainer. And the problem is that I read labels that are gluten-free, have no wheat,
that are just as bad,
that have all the rest of this crap, and we're blaming it on gluten. Well, gluten, yes, is a problem for most Americans now to some degree or another, but I guarantee that if you're going to eat this product and put so much soap in your body, you're going to have the same problem as the gluten gives you.
Now, I pulled up the ingredients to a gluten-free bread.
Okay, so first of all, by the way, the recipe that I just read was for Doritos.
Yeah.
Doritos out of the bag. This is the Nacho Doritos, a very, very popular product, okay? So let's read what's in the gluten-free.
All right, this one is no gluten, wheat-free, dairy-free, and low-calorie.
Woo-woo.
All right.
That's got to be good for you, right?
It has.
Everything in this recipe is going to be health. It's going to be the blossom of health. It's going to be so filled with love because there's no gluten in it and no dairy. No lactose, no gluten. It's got to be just...
And the proof of that?
The embodiment of love.
Is in the brown craft paper package.
The brown, that's right. It's in brown paper or green paper. We know that's true.
Soy ink on brown paper. Craft paper.
Okay, read me. Okay. This has got to be a great recipe. This has got to be a recipe for health. This will heal the world.
These are the ingredients to a bread product. It's bread, gluten-free, that's everywhere in just about every health food store. It's in Walmart. It's in our Mama Jeans here locally. All right, starts with water, rice flour, sugar, tapioca starch, corn starch,
sugar,
yeast, soybean oil, potato starch,
sugar,
modified corn starch,
sugar,
eggs, rice starch,
sugar,
psyllium,
yep,
leavening, which includes baking soda and sodium acid pyrophosphate.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maltodextrin.
Sugar.
Dextrose,
sugar,
preservatives, which include calcium propionate,
okay.
Yep, sorbic acid, and then it has a xanthan gum, terrible on the gut, by the way.
Yeah, that's just, oh my
that's
gosh.
That's worse than detergent. Xanthan gum on the intestine, oh, okay, I digress. Salt, citric acid, polyglycerol esters.
Oh, whatever, that's soap.
Mono and diglycerides. Natural flavor, soy lecithin and soy flour.
Okay, so what you've got is a highly processed product that is just as bad without the gluten as the gluten product.
Yeah, there is so much starch and sugar in this mixed with something as ridiculous as xanthan gum.
Yeah.
And detergent, all rolled into one. Of course they have to have the detergent in this. All of this starch would totally bind up the equipment.
It's going to become a rock. It's not going to turn into bread if you don't have something in there to keep it bread. Let's go to a health food product.
This smells a health food product.
That's not the embodiment of health that gluten-free should be. Anybody who is eating a gluten-free...
You are so judgmental.
I know, I'm terrible, aren't I? Anybody's eating a gluten-free diet and doing the dance of joy or doing the dance of joy to the toilet because I can tell you why they're not getting well, why they're continuing to
they're
be
swallowing
gluten.
Soap.
Garbage. It's garbage. You're putting so much garbage in your body and calling it gluten-free. You know, I don't care how many red spots you paint in the middle of your forehead. It's not going to make you... You know, well, it's not going to help. Listen to this good food. Now, this is a food that is supposed to be specifically good for your digestive system and for your heart. It's heart healthy.
Oh, okay.
This one begins with whole grain wheat. Okay, so there's gluten there, but it's whole grain. So that's got to be better than the industry standard, right? It has all the parts of the grain, right?
Yeah.
Corn bran, wheat bran.
High fiber.
Yeah,
okay.
So this
okay.
is the waste off of corn and wheat.
Yeah. But we all know fiber.
Fiber is good.
Reduces hunger.
Well, and you know, it's you've got to have that fiber, that bulk in your digestive system in order to stay regular, okay? So the next one is inulin. Inulin is what? It's a carbohydrate, but it does an interesting thing in the body. It's actually a drug.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a plant carbohydrate, but it's used because of its similar activity to a similar sounding hormone called
insulin. Yeah.
Inulin helps and assists the body in absorbing and taking in glucose.
Uh-huh.
It opens the glucose receptors of the cells, okay? It's a sugar. The next, and you'll see why there's inulin in this, it's a sugar that actually helps to reduce insulin resistance on the cellular level. You'll see why it has to be in this product in a minute, because the next the next ingredient is sugar. Now, that's white processed table sugar.
Uh-huh.
And then there's whole grain oats. And the next ingredient is sugar. And then the next ingredient is malt extract, which is
sugar.
Sugar. And then there's salt. And then there's BHT, a preservative, to keep the sugars intact. And then, lo and behold, the next ingredient is brown sugar.
For flavor, right?
I don't know, because the next ingredient is high fructose corn syrup.
Oh, my gosh. That's because the brown sugar is too expensive, and high fructose corn syrup is very cheap.
I don't know. I guess maybe the whole grain wheat and the corn bran and the wheat bran are just nasty tasting. So it has to have six different kinds of sugar so far. And we're only to the middle of the recipe. So the next is soybean oil, honey, which is sugar.
Five different kinds.
And that's six.
Uh-huh.
And now brown sugar molasses.
Flavor. It's for the flavoring.
Oh, it's sugar.
Absolutely.
Seven sugars. And then salt again. Wheat bits, which is whole wheat, cornstarch, corn flour, sugar, and salt. And trisodium phosphate with color
added. There's the detergent. Yep.
Now, in order to have any kind of flavor in this hodgepodge, other than sweet, they add cinnamon flavor. Now, cinnamon flavor is not from cinnamon.
No, no.
Cinnamon flavor comes from the middlings of oil manufacture. Mm-hmm. So this is a petroleum product. It's an artificial flavor. But they're actually naming it so they don't have to say artificial flavor.
Mm-hmm.
They can say cinnamon flavor and get away with it. Sucralose. What is sucralose?
Ew.
What is sucralose? Let's be clear on this.
Well, sucralose is, an obvious answer is an artificial sweetener, but actually it's a pseudo-sweet cytotoxin, neurotoxin.
Okay, a chemist.
Produced by specific bacteria in laboratories.
No, it's actually produced.
Oh, no, that's aspartame.
Right.
I got the two mixed up.
No, the sucralose is actually derived from the bleaching materials.
Right.
From the sugar factory.
Yeah.
When they take the sugar.
The aspartame and the sucralose.
Right. When they take the sugar cane molasses or the beet molasses and it's brown, it's really dark and it's brown, they've got to bleach this stuff to a white sugar. So there's a leftover material that they then dehydrate and powder, and they call it sucralose. It's a cellulose with the sucrose leftovers in it. It's just awful. It's hideous, and it's got a lot of bleaching in it, so they don't have to name the bleach. They do not have to name the bleach in sucralose because the EPA has allowed them, and the FDA, thank God for the FDA, they have allowed them to name it something else. You know, and instead of being encephalitis, it's like naming it polio, they're now naming it encephalitis.
Uh-huh.
And so polio is cured, but there's all kinds of, okay, I digress. That's not even on this subject, right? But
no, for next week's time.
For my next week. Okay, so I'm not finished yet here.
I wouldn't even pick something like this up off the shelf with that many ingredients. I don't go past, six ingredients at most when I'm buying something off the shelf.
And so then we've got, after the sucralose, we've got walnut meal, almond meal, and way down here in the ingredients list, that means that there's barely any.
Uh-huh.
It's hardly even there. And then non-fat milk. And tocopherol, which is vitamin E, and BHT, more BHT. So the vast majority of this recipe is sugar and salt. The vast majority of this recipe, and this is Fiber One Honey Cluster cereal. This is something that is actually prescribed for elderly people in rest homes.
Uh-huh.
It's prescribed. Ugh. And
he crunched up the paper, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, so here's my difficulty with the whole matter. The whole thing boils down to the gluten. I hear so many people, I've heard it again and again this week, I've taken gluten out of my diet, and that's supposed to be a good thing. And so when I stop them and ask them, you know, are you reading the labels on everything that you eat? Well, no, I've taken gluten out of my diet, sir.
And they stop there.
Yeah, doctor, I've taken gluten out of my gluten and milk.
Yeah,
because
gluten,
you know,
and dairy are the major culprits to irritable bowel, you know.
Irritable bowel is gluten and milk. And if you just take gluten and dairy out of your diet, you're not going to have irritable bowel. And yet they're still sick. The reason they're in my office is because they're still sick. So I asked the question, well, do you read labels? And they said, why should I read labels? I read the label. It says gluten and lactose free. I'm good.
Did you turn the label around?
But they don't.
So you can see
people do not read
the
label. And so the rule is anything in a bag, bottle, box, or can, whether it has gluten in it or not, you read and understand the label. And if you cannot tell me if you can't track down the source of the ingredient and tell me how it is food and what is its purpose in the recipe, or better yet, if you can't pronounce the ingredient and you can't tell me what it's for in the recipe, the rule is that you put the product back on the shelf, and you do not vote for it in the election of public opinion. You do not beg the corporations to make this for you and call it food. You do not beg the corporations to provide your health and then demand that they make this kind of food by buying it. Isn't that right? Wouldn't that make sense?
And look, there's a whole ton of really bad information about health on the internet.
Oh, there really is.
But you know what? There's a whole ton of information that is exactly what it's supposed to be. You look down a list of ingredients, and if you can't pronounce or explain what one ingredient is, we're in the information age. You pull out a smartphone, or you write it down.
Oh my
you
gosh.
Go to a computer, and you look up that ingredient. You find out if it's used in industry. If it's used in industry, it should not be in food.
Right. If it's used in industry, why are you eating that stuff? There's another rule. You know, when you read a label, and it's bread. I mean, let's go through the ingredients of bread. You've made bread.
Uh-huh.
What's in bread? Grandma's bread.
Yeah. Home stone ground wheat.
Stone ground wheat. So that's one.
Yep.
Wheat.
Honey.
Honey. Because it's going to have some flavor, right?
The honey's for the flavor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because at home, we really don't care whether it's sweet or not. The honey is for flavor and to activate the yeast.
And to give some food for the yeast to grow. And then there's what?
Salt.
Salt.
And either water or milk, depending on how thick and moist we wanted the bread to be.
Water or milk, and
that's it.
Yeast.
Yeast, yeah.
That's five ingredients, and you know what each of those ingredients are for. I defy you to read the label on any bread, health food or otherwise, and have five ingredients.
Yeah, I will eat... I'm not gluten intolerant, air quotes.
air quote alert.
But I will eat occasionally from a restaurant or from a health food store, bread products that leave me queasy afterward.
A little nauseous.
A little bloated, a little, it's like my body is working extra hard to process this.
Because
stuff.
You know what?
But you know, I never once have had any problem with the high gluten homemade bread.
If I eat too much, I do obviously.
If I eat too much, okay. That's a lot of starch, that's a lot of gluten, and I'm a glutton when it comes to homemade bread.
I think a lot of the culprit there is the smell of it when it's cooking. And then you know that when you put that butter on there, it's going to melt, and a little more honey. Oh my gosh, a little cup of hot chocolate and a nice piece of homemade bread, and we eat too much of it. And obviously, when
one serving would be okay,
but we eat too much.
It's never just one serving when it's so hot and fresh right out of the oven.
Yeah, okay. And here's the other thing. When the rest of the time you're eating the kind of garbage that passes for food out there, and then you eat a piece of homemade bread, it's going to have the same effect as the garbage.
Oh, yeah.
So you're just adding to the garbage.
No, the garbage has already impacted
there.
Your system. Your system has already had to adapt to it.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a the gluten crisis borders on myth standards. The gluten crisis is real. People are really sick. But what pushes it over into the nutraceutical myth or the health myth department is what corporations are doing in order to make a whole bunch of money on the suffering, on the backs of suffering people. And that offends me. That really, really offends me. But to answer the question that was sent in, why do some people, you know, really, really react badly to gluten and other people don't? They don't seem to react at all? Well, it is because probably of what they are or are not adding into the mix. I don't react to gluten at all, and I have irritable bowel disease. I have a long history of bowel disease, not only in my family, but in myself. I've had cancer in my bowel, and I've had Crohn's colitis, and I continue to have irritable bowel. The only time that I have problems with gluten, oddly, because this is, I guess, by definition, not possible, the only time I ever have problems with gluten is when I eat the packaged or bagged food from industry, or if I eat too much of the wonderful homemade waffles or pancakes or bread, you know, because it's so really, really good that I haven't got the whole third part of the major food rule down, and that is eat real food and mostly plant and not too much. If I could figure out the not too much, I would probably not have irritable bowel at all.
If anybody's wondering where that expression comes from, all credit goes to Michael Pollan, who directed and...
Pollan.
I thought it was Pollock. It is Pollan.
Okay, look it up.
In defense of food.
What, you know, an amazing articulation of truth. Michael has really nailed it. And it's so simple, that we have adopted it. I've adopted it personally. And if I've mispronounced your name, I apologize, because I probably taught myself the wrong name all this time. But Michael, good on you. Good on you. What are some of the other myths? Well, we're talking myths.
Well, in answer to the second question we got tonight, there was
all
the matter of cleansing.
Yeah,
and what's funny is that the cleansing fad is... can be directly connected to irritable bowel. We've seen it a lot. When people engage in these heavy cleanses, these radical cleanses, and then express irritable bowel that lasts a long time.
Yeah, that goes on and on. Goes on and on. Okay, so cleansing. Let's understand what cleansing the bowel is, because, you know, we've used this term, liver cleanse, bowel cleanse, lymph cleanse, circulatory cleanse.
What does it mean to cleanse?
Lung cleanse, cleanse. Cleanse means to hurt a little bit the tissues of a target area. So if you're going to do a bowel cleanse, how do you go about it? All the cleanses work this way, okay? Even the fast works this way. You actually cause damage, a little bit of damage. First of all, you cause clearing because you cause inflammation and damage. All of the herbs that are cleanses for the bowel are either cleanses because they irritate the lining of the bowel and therefore cause inflammation, and the body then throws water at the irritation, which lubricates the chyme and brings the gunk out. But the irritation, the inflammation is still there. And much of those inflammatory breakdown products pass through into the blood.
Yeah.
It's not a good idea. And the other types of bowel cleanses are softeners of stool. So
right.
Stool softener is, again, something, it's something that causes the body to throw fluid from your body into the bowel.
And the third type of bowel cleanse that I know of would be the spasmic bowel cleanse.
Right.
The substances that cause the peristaltic muscles to enter into rapid contraction to expel the contents.
Yeah, those are mechanical laxatives.
Yeah.
So people get a little bit confused. You do a liver cleanse, for example, you're actually using herbs, substances that cause a small amount of damage to the cells of your liver. The liver is then triggered to replace those cells. And ideally, if you're giving your body the right kind of food, your liver will replace those cells with healthy cells. And you get a, air quote, cleanse. But if you are not, if you're feeding your body this stuff that I just read
and crumpled,
if you're feeding your body this and calling it food, then you know what? You do not rebuild anything.
No.
So you end up with damage by cleansing. And the bowel is the same way. We talked to a lady today. She's older. She's in her golden years, and she uses an herbal laxative, and many, many people have to.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
They have things going on, but I'm here to tell you, if you get in the habit of cleansing, cleanse, you're going to get to where it is a habit. It's as much a habit as drinking alcohol is for an alcoholic,
and also as much a habit in the body as taking enzymes regularly.
Right.
The body doesn't have to produce the enzymes if it has enzymes already in it from some product.
Exactly. It doesn't see the need, and so it doesn't produce, and you end up dependent. Dependent upon cleansing, dependency upon cleansing is a very, very bad thing. Once in a while, a cleanse is good. And I would suggest that if you really feel like you've got a bunch of gunk in your gut, drink water. Cleanse by fasting a couple of days and drink a lot of water and juice and just clean it all out. Get clean and clear of the material that's in your gut. It's made to evacuate. Allow it to evacuate. And just don't feed the pipeline for a few days. You will cleanse out.
A big factor out there is the whole cleanse to detox.
Cleanse to detox.
And people will cleanse and cleanse and cleanse to detox and detox and detox some more without really realizing what exactly that means. You don't detox.
You produce more toxins.
By cleansing. Cleansing produces toxins.
Cleansing produces toxins, and that's why the body throws so much water at the area. That's what inflammation is all about.
Cleansing the liver doesn't detox the liver. Mm-hmm. Cleansing the liver kills liver cells that the liver then has to reproduce.
Cleansing the kidneys kill cells that have to be stripped out and then regenerated. Cleansing the pancreas, cleansing the spleen, cleansing the gallbladder. Well, cleansing the gallbladder is a matter of evacuation.
Right.
But, and that's the same as the bowel. Uh-huh. Allow the bowel to evacuate and it will be cleansed.
And allow any of the organs to function properly.
And they will
do their job. The liver and the kidneys will detox
the
system. The body works this way.
The body is made this way. I cannot tell you how many people, when we sit them down and we ask them, what is ailing you? And they tell us, well, I'm just so sick all the time. I just feel like I need to get rid of these toxins.
Uh-huh.
And, I'm doing this detox and that detox. And when we ask them to show us or write a list or bring in their bottles of products that they have bought from the corpse,
mm-hmm.
from the corpses, I mean the corporations, having to detox their bodies, we take and we write down a list of ingredients that they're taking in terms of herbs and supplements, and we treat it like it's a list of ingredients on the package of our Doritos. We find so much chemistry that it becomes impossible for the body to function at all, and you start to have collapse.
Mm-hmm.
You start to have the body shut you down and not even allow you to move. You become so fatigued that you can't function.
It can't catch up with the chemical warfare.
You're asking it to do so much work through chemical warfare that it simply can't catch up. The best cleanse that there is for the body is water.
And a little bit of fasting now and then.
Fasting. And eat plants that have a lot of water.
Get plenty of exercise.
Plants that have a lot of water in them are the mucilaginous plants. Mm-hmm. And they assist the bowel to evacuate. And if you will put those back into your diet and actually cook food again, instead of begging the corporations to fix this problem for you, come up with some technology, iRobot. What was the name of the... I don't even want to go there. the robot in the
in the zombie movie, so you're all going to die down here. Well, yeah, we're all going to die down here because we put these things in our food. And I have to ask myself all the time, why do you eat that? Why do I eat that? I mean, why indeed? If we would pay attention to the two basic rules, eat food, real food. Make sure that you know the food that you're eating, that you just, you haven't just, you know, begged the corporations to send you down a bag of this or a can of that and call it food and that's good. If you eat real food, mostly plant, because that's how we're made, not all plant necessarily, but mostly plant, and not too much, you're going to find that your body cleanses naturally.
Because it's built to.
And automatically.
Yeah.
It's going to cleanse automatically.
You won't need enzyme supplements. You won't need probiotic supplements.
Yeah.
You won't need most of the supplement vitamins and minerals unless you're in areas where you just don't have certain kinds.
Look at it. And you know what? We can say this because the majority of our ministerial practice is spent in helping people get off of
their drugs,
their supplements, get off. We're not even helping, we're not even spending any time at all to speak of helping people move away from medicine, from the practice of medicine. We are now trying to play catch up with our colleagues. We're not catching up. We are trying to get people away from the 40 and 50 and 60 different supplements they're buying, wasting their resources, destroying their finances, and collapsing their health.
Yeah.
That's what people are going through who come to us. We see it just about every day that we come in the office.
Mm-hmm.
It is heinous. It's a great crime, and it's our profession that's doing it. It needs to stop. It needs to stop. Natural healthcare practitioners need to stop. They need to step back, and they need to gain competence, not rely on their weekend seminars that got them into the business of natural healing, but obtain, grow a little integrity. That's what I'm asking. Grow a little morality, a little integrity. Get the competence. Understand the workings of the body. And get off the fads and the myths, because all you're doing is hurting people.
You want if folks want a safe cleanse, don't buy one.
Yeah, don't buy one.
Don't buy a, quote, safe cleanse.
Don't.
Study the workings of the body. Find, study the systems you want to target and find ways to support those systems naturally and with food, because those systems will do their jobs if given the proper tools. Stripping stripping them of old and tired cells is something the organs do themselves. Your body does that itself. Very, very seldom is it necessary to put a chemotherapy into the liver to cause it to slough off bad old and tired cells.
It's an allopathic principle that has found its way into natural medicine. One of the keystones of natural medicine is that whatever you do, whether it's energy or food chemistry or what have you, whatever you do is to sustain and support the body's own intrinsic healing ability. And so important is that issue that in all states that have the licensure for naturopaths, that language is in there. Naturopathy is a modality of healing that works with natural substances, materials, and methods, modalities that sustain and support the body's intrinsic ability to heal. That means that it's in there. It's happening automatically. But we can't get in our own way, and that's what's happening. We are getting in our own way, and the corporations are making a lot of money because we have this propensity to default to the big guys.
Yeah.
The big guys that have proven that they can make money, and so therefore, because they can make money, they're successes, and because they're successes, they must be gods. It's like they make this huge jump between success financially and heaven. You know, those corporations have climbed the cross, and they're standing in the top of the cross above God and the angels, and we beg them to help us. Mm-hmm. We beg them to give us what we need. Water, mild food, with all tenderness. and mindfulness. And this is cleansing.
Yeah, whenever the inclination or the urge comes to get the toxins out of our gut, rather than jump to a cleanse to strip it, go to something that builds and supports the gut, doesn't strip it, doesn't flush it. Go to something mucilaginous. Go to slippery elm, marshmallow root. Go to gentle foods.
Cucumbers.
Uh-huh. Vegetables, squash.
And water.
And water.
Lots and lots and lots of water.
It's actually the opposite of what the naturopathic, of contemporary naturopathy recommends.
It's true.
Contemporary naturopathy recommends this cleansing herb and that cleansing herb, and there's usually a combination in a bottle.
Right. Yeah, in a pill. In a pill. So then naturopaths.
Traditional naturopathy.
So-called naturopaths. So-called herbalists, so-called holistic healers are supposed to be addressing the body, the mind, and the spirit. And how they address the body is they pack a bunch of harsh chemotherapy in the form of herbs.
Dry powder.
Dry powder, harsh chemotherapy in a hypromelose capsule because there's no animal byproducts in that. There's no animal matter. It's all plant hypromelose. You know, they stuff that in a
semi-synthetic shell.
Yeah, a semi-synthetic shell of tile adhesive, and then spray it or put in there the phytase so that it'll break open, but the phytase will have destroyed all the plant matter, made it unuseful, and now all you have is the caustic, dangerous chemotherapy flowing out. This is supposed to be natural medicine. And I'm here to tell you, as a naturopath, as a national board certified naturopath, shame on us all. Shame on us all. We have sold ourselves down the river. We have prostituted the intrinsic healing ability of the body. And if you're one of those, as I was for so long, repent. This is the gospel we're teaching. Repent. Think again. That's what repent means, by the way. It means
rethink.
Think. It comes from the verb to think. Think it over again. Step back. Grow some morality. Grow some integrity. Get real competence and go back to the real medicine. Come out of Babylon, I implore you.
You can tell we live in the Bible Belt.
Come out of the Babylon of corporate oppression. Come out of the Babylon of corporate exploitation of suffering people. So, okay, water. We got just a few minutes left.
And water's a fun topic.
If water is the best cleanse out there, water, mild vegetable foods, and all tenderness, if that is, and mindfulness, if that is the best cleanse out there, you know, a partial fast with water and some mild vegetable food for the bowel, for the kidneys, for the liver, for the lungs.
First off, can I say, I'd like to point out to our audience tonight a statement that's made in supposed truth. It's represented as absolute truth that is absolutely false.
And what is that?
That our body only absorbs 10% of the water we drink.
That's absolutely not true.
It's everywhere. I have found it in so many sources, especially advocates of distilled water.
Do you know where that comes from? It comes from the statement that you only use 10% of your brain.
No, it doesn't.
Well, it's the same percent. It must come from the same place, right? Also untrue.
No, it comes from a couple of so-called doctors, though their doctor status can't be verified because it's too long ago, who were partly responsible for development of home distillation units.
Oh.
Water distillation units. There are a couple of these manufacturers who put out a research that indicated that water, only 10% of the water that we drink can be absorbed by the body because of all the stuff that's in it. And therefore, only distilled water should be consumed.
And that's just bullpucking.
Absolutely.
Distilled water. I mean, if you take, give me a nice bunch of lemon balm. And I'll put that in some warm water, and it doesn't even have to be hot water, and it'll distill, or it will infuse the oils and the chemistry of the melissa will go into the water, and I'll drink that, and I'll gain clarity because it's minimally produced.
Uh-huh.
But you take that same handful and you dry it and you grind it and you put it into a capsule and you swallow it. I don't care how much water you drink with it; it's going to do squat because of the amount of processing that you have subjected that good herb to. Well, I'm here to tell you, the same applies to water. The amount of processing to which you apply, or that you subject that water, that's what the usefulness of the water will depend upon. So take good, clean, let's just take purified water.
Just purified.
Water that's been really nicely filtered. So So it's not tap water. Okay, it's not spring water. You can't get access to a really nice spring coming up from 1,000 feet below and through the limestone, you know, and it's just really pristine and clean, and you can't get that.
Mm.
So get the best purified water you have, and now put it in a pot and superheat it. Cook the daylights out of it. Cook it so that it changes nature and becomes steam.
Mm.
And then precipitate it back again, and you know, you have super processed that water.
Mm-hmm.
You have denatured the water. You have made it a Frankenwater. It's not even water anymore. It's Frankenstein water.
Plants don't like it.
Distilled water. No. What immediately happens is the distilled water rushes, or distilled water is a void. And so other matter that likes to work with water, because water is the universal solvent, all around the earth, other elements will rush into empty water.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you place distilled water in your body, things rush into it. It's not so much that you're putting clean water into your body, you're putting dead empty water, and your soil makes it living again.
Your body has to resurrect the water.
It does. It resurrects the water. It takes that distilled water and turns it into water again. And it is the water of life, and it is the solvent again, but it is laden with that which makes you alive. So would it not be better to put living water into a living body than dead water into a living body?
I would think so.
Yeah. I mean, I have a tooth that has to come out of my mouth. It's dead. I have to go have it pulled. How wise would it be to leave that tooth in my head? It's dead matter.
Not good.
It would be horribly unwise to leave that tooth in my head, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's not really causing me a toothache right now, so maybe I'll just leave it in there till it does.
I remember years ago when we were living in Utah, there was a woman that was coming to you as a naturopath in Utah who was showing demonstrative signs of hypocalcemia, and she was experiencing some bone loss, but she was eating all kinds of different foods that should have taken care of all of these things, and she was hydrating profusely. And I remember how baffling it was going through all the signs and all the symptoms, and nothing was really adding up until we looked really closely at the water she was drinking.
Right.
It was all distilled water.
She had drunk distilled water for 20 years.
Her body had to buffer that empty, dead water with the solute minerals from her own blood and bones.
Right, from her tissues.
Yep.
You know, different kinds of tissues around the body. The body will buffer the water and make it living again. Can you afford to do that kind of cleansing? Can you afford to strip your own nutrient in order to make your water living? Wouldn't it be better, wouldn't it be better to put living water into your body, your living body, than to put dead water in your body? Well, the answer to that question is yes. Every bit as much as it's not wise to leave a dead tooth in my head.
But do you want the sludge in your water? And I say, yes, I want the sludge in my water.
Well, I don't want...
No, we don't want...
There's a fine line here. There is water that is terrible,
mm-hmm.
and most municipal waters are terrible. So you're going to want to be doing some good filtration.
Yeah.
You're going to want to be purifying and cleansing your water. But even your distilled water,
mm-hmm.
I would rather that once you have distilled it, that you put a pinch of sea salt in that distilled water. Bring it back to life before you put it in your body.
I remember back, I was working in a facility where distilled water was the drinking water. The tap water was not good to drink. It was an industrial location, so you didn't drink the tap water.
No, it wasn't great water.
Uh-huh. And the distilled water was used in the manufacturing process. So they just bought extra distilled water
to drink. Sure.
And I remember after about a month of drinking the distilled water, trying to stay hydrated, that I started to really drag. I really started to drag. And I would try to hydrate a little bit more, I try to eat a little bit better, and I was still dragging terribly.
The fact is that when you drink distilled water, you're asking your body to work. Your water that you drink should replenish. It should be a relief to the body. It should be a breath of fresh air. It should be a rest. Water should be a rest for your body. It should be rejuvenating.
Not stripping.
It should be vivifying. It shouldn't be asking your body to toil.
Right.
And that's what we're doing when we put ruined, dead water in your body. You're asking your body to work harder than you ought to.
As soon as I began buffering the water I was drinking using a good sea salt, I think I was using Redmond real salt. Anyway, my energy level started to come back. And
just
it was
a teens.
Yeah, just a
it
little
doesn't
bit.
Even take enough to make the water salty. Uh-huh. Just sweeten a little bit, and suddenly that water is alive again. It's alive again. Anciently, our ancestors would take obsidian crystals. And
I've
salt.
Done that too. Yep.
Obsidian crystals and salt. And they put a little bit of salt in the water and some obsidian crystals and shake it.
Mm-hmm.
Or in a bowl or in a skin. Shake, 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 shake. And they would drink that water for the energy. They energize the crystalline structure of the water, and they put mineral in the water. That is an alternative that is amazing.
That's dang cool is what it is.
Yeah, you've got to do that stuff. You've got to do that kind of stuff. I was asked today, what do you think of high pH water? You have these machines out there, and there's a bunch of them now,
mm-hmm.
that because of the alkaline acid diet,
there we go.
argument, acid food as opposed to alkaline food, and the alkaline diet is superior. I'm not going to argue that point. We need to be a slightly alkaline environment
mm-hmm.
in our bodies where that's appropriate. There are a couple of places where that is not appropriate. The bladder, for one, and the woman's uterus is another, where, an alkaline environment is not necessarily a good thing.
Right, yeah.
But in most of the rest of the body, neutral to slightly alkaline
mm-hmm.
is good. So these companies are now taking water, and they're saying, you got to drink lots of water. So here's what we'll do. You're eating a diet that tanks your pH, so you're always down. Your saliva is always down around 6.4 and 6.5.
Uh-huh.
And this is a troubling thing because it could precipitate some bad problems, right? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to make a machine that brings the pH of your water way up. So when you drink the water,
it brings your body pH up.
Yeah, because it dilutes with all of your water, and it brings your pH up. Well, what happens then, folks, is that your body has to buffer. So drink that 8.4 water, Kangen.
Water does not.
Drink that stuff, and your body will buffer it down to neutral. So how does it buffer it down to neutral?
By adding acid.
It produces acids. If you're in an acid state, your body is constantly trying to use your minerals to
mm-hmm.
buffer up to neutral. If you're in a highly alkaline state that's over the normal,
uh-huh.
like this highly pH high water, then your body will bring that down by adding acids. Now, how do we get the water so alkaline in the first place? Most of these machines do a certain thing.
Yeah, and I know that most of them keep the process itself highly proprietary.
Highly proprietary.
They don't want you to know how it happens,
yeah.
How they do it.
Most of them are actually adding chlorine or hydrogen substances to the water.
That, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you smell this water, and it smells like bleach. It's crazy. And there's a process in the machines that allows it to do this, but... The bottom line is that your body will buffer down the pH.
Which is why eating foods that alkalize or acidify is the effective way, means of regulating the body's internal pH. Because they're acidifying or they're alkalizing based on the constituents in the plant. It's how the body reacts to the food. What it does with the food that determines whether it's alkalizing or acidifying.
Now, there's the key right there. The key is the food alkalizing? Is it alkaline forming, or is it acid forming?
Mm-hmm.
Not whether the food is acid or alkaline.
Right.
It's what your body does with it. So if you're in an acid state, if you're in a mild acidosis, a serum acidosis, for example, below the optimal, you're going to want to eat plants that have the solute minerals in them that the body can use to buffer up. Otherwise, your body's going to use your minerals to buffer up.
And where is it going to get those minerals from?
It's a limited supply, folks. You're going to get calcium out of your red blood cells or from your bones. So calcium is the go-to guy for buffering the mineral level.
Calcium, magnesium,
first of all,
potassium.
It's going to be your bicarbonates first, and when those run out and are not effective, you're going to start leaching. Your body's going to start removing calcium, potassium, magnesium from other tissues, bone tissues being one of them, red blood cell tissues being the other. So buffering up is a matter of putting in your body plants that have the minerals. And the body will use the minerals from the plants instead of minerals from you.
The body will always choose the readier supply of these materials.
The supply
that begins consuming itself.
Ready at hand, that's right. So if you're in a highly alkaline state or an over-alkaline state, which is extremely rare, you're never going to be there, by the way. The kind of food that we eat, you are not going to be over. Every good thing that we eat is going to put you in the right zone. You have to have some pretty specific diseases to get into an alkalosis.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, in that case, it's going to be bicarbonates to neutralize the alkaloids. And that's just the way it is. It's not going to be done appropriately or safely by drinking. You know, I've heard people who are drinking water that's 8.5 all the way up to 12.0. You can take the paint. You can take the paint off of your car with 8.5 water. What the heck are you swallowing that for? Why are you buying this bull crap? I mean, these things are expensive. This stuff is expensive.
Drink good, clean water.
Yeah, just don't drink that stuff. Don't swallow that. You know, Bob. Don't marry that harpy. Bob, we got to start. It's like the movie Sahara. We got to start rethinking
our decision-making paradigm.
At some point, we need to start rethinking our decision-making paradigm. But we get out of control on our I don't know if we're out of control, but we get really passionate. And the reason this is that we get passionate is because, you know, after all, natural medicine should be the practice of religion.
It really
should be. And science and technology and the reformation or the great enlightenment that happened has made it impossible for many natural healers to even think of healing as religion anymore. But to us, it is the practice of the very practice of our religion. And that's why I can say for you so-called naturopaths and you so-called herbalists and you so-called natural healers out there who are just pill pushers, you know who you are. You need to be embarrassed by your behavior. You need to grow some integrity and make this the practice of religion again. The practice of religion religion relieves suffering. They hold up the hands that hang down. You know, you are visiting, you're judging the fatherless, in other words, providing for the fatherless, visiting the widow in her need, and relieving suffering. Relieving suffering is
natural medicine, and that needs to be the practice of our religion. And that's why we can get passionate about these things.
Yeah.
We can be so passionate about these things, and we need to be making answers happen for these things. This is the Menha Radio, and we're at the end of our hour and a half. And I want to thank you for tuning in, and be with us again next Tuesday. We're going to talk about some other things along these lines, some of the environmental toxins and the use of plant minerals and some other things that we've been asked about mm-hmm. by our sufferers that come into our office. This is Chief Cloud Piler and Chief Huilamutkin saying, walk sacred, and signing off for another week. Thanks again for being here.